The North Carolina Radio Reading Service brings this program to blind and print-impaired listeners. It's the Indie Week, and it's read today by John Federson. This week's issue is dated July 14th of 2021. And I'm glad to be with you folks, and we're also glad to bring back some old friends of the program to perform our theme music today. You might remember from several years past the duet from the Old Ireland Auto Body Shop, and they're back. They call themselves, of course, the Repeat Offenders. And they'll return at the end of our program today. And let's get to our program. This issue of Indie Week is the annual awards issue, Best of the Triangle. And with all the articles there are to read, I'm not sure if we'll get into any of the awards, but we'll keep this on file in case we need to fill in some space in future broadcasts. The IndieWeek.com online will get you that entire article, including all the awards. There's hundreds of them in there. Food, shops, all various things, services, and sites to be seen around. And very worthwhile having a look at that. So let's get to our articles today. Article 1 by Lee Heffernan is titled Changing Gears. If you've ever biked to work, you're probably familiar with long commute times, fighting for your life amid speeding cars and showing up to the office drenched in sweat. The proposed Triangle Bikeway would improve commuting by bike, making it a cheap, viable, sustainable, and downright enjoyable transit option. It's unclear now, though, if the project will come to fruition or meet an untimely death, as did the canceled Durham-Orange light rail transit project. If the bikeway is built, who will reap its benefits? That will likely depend on federal funding and the degree to which planners successfully address equity concerns. Last month, the Triangle Bikeway team shared a project update and recommended route for the 17-mile walking and biking path that would connect Raleigh, Cary, Morrisville, RTP, Durham, and Chapel Hill. The bikeway will also run through regional parks, pass by the streets at South Point, and come close to Raleigh-Durham International Airport. Although the Triangle has good biking infrastructure, including buses with bike racks and greenways like the American Tobacco Trail, there are gaps in coverage. Most buses can only hold two bikes at a time, and existing bike paths are not always well connected to each other or to key destinations. Those problems would be remedied by the bikeway, says John Reese, president of the Bicycle Alliance of Chapel Hill and a member of the Triangle Bikeway Study Working Group. He says, it would allow you to make trips through the Triangle that currently are not possible. Reese commuted from Chapel Hill to his job in RTP by bus and bike before the pandemic. And he says, I felt so much better when I got to work than I would have if I'd been sitting in the car and dealing with the stress of traffic. It's very invigorating, and it's a good way to incorporate exercise. Since standard electric bikes reach speeds of up to 20 miles per hour, you could ride the entire bikeway in around 50 minutes. The majority of commuters won't have to ride the full 17 miles to reach their destination, meaning an e-bike may get you to work faster than driving in rush hour traffic. And biking is significantly cheaper than driving, even if you have to buy an electric bike. For now, many details about the bikeway remain unspecified. A recommended route has been proposed based on an initial survey conducted last fall that solicited more than 2,000 responses about desired destinations, commuting patterns, estimated frequency of use, and route preferences. The study team is taking responses for a second survey until July the 16th. And guess what? That's today, I believe. Asking questions about frequency of use, reasons for travel, preferred access points, and where users would like to walk, as opposed to bike, along the pathway. There is currently no official projected user count, price tag or established source of funding, says Iona Thomas, the bikeway's project manager from McAdams, a Durham-based civil engineering company providing consulting services for this project. Over two-thirds of the initial survey's respondents said they would use the bikeway at least once weekly. Building the bikeway will help achieve the Triangle's urban planning goals like those established by local metropolitan planning organizations. The Durham, Chapel Hill, Carrboro, and NC Capital Area metropolitan planning organizations are working together to create their 2050 Metropolitan Transportation Plan, the MTP, which will impact all transportation projects in the Triangle, including the bikeway, for the next 30 years. DHC and CAMPO released a bilingual online survey during the summer of 2020 to understand support for goals and objectives that would guide development of the MTP. Feedback from approximately 1,200 respondents influenced the plan's official goals and objectives, approved in September. Close to two-thirds of the respondents ranked walking and biking and increasing transit services among their top five policies to prioritize. The MPO aligned its objectives with the survey response by making one of its main goals to ensure that everyone has access to a diverse set of affordable transit modes, including bicycling and walking. But the survey did not reach a representative portion of the Triangle's population. People of color account for almost half of those living in the survey area, but they comprised just under 15% of respondents. When results came in from the initial bikeway survey, once again, only around 15% of respondents were people of color. Officials involved with the bikeway say they are aware of the problem and hope to remedy it during subsequent public feedback periods. There's also still time to diversify public feedback on the 2050 MTP, since the MPOs are asking for responses regarding the project's deficiency and needs analysis. Rees says he's concerned that bike share programs will not be accessible to everyone. He says a lot of times we get all excited about technology and people can use their phones and watches or something like that to hop on a bike share, and obviously not everyone has the money to have a modern smartphone or smartwatch. He also worries that routes connecting people to the main bikeway path will get axed as the project proceeds. It's common for these connectors to hit snags due to unexpected circumstances that raise costs or previously planned development that delays or kills construction. If communities are heavily involved in the public feedback process, they can advocate against losing a connector. Pushing back becomes more difficult when you are unable to raise your concerns by accessing feedback surveys. If you lack Wi-Fi, a computer, or smartphone, or transportation to a public space that offers free internet access. The online survey was specifically designed to reach out to people who might not traditionally participate in a study like this, says Dale McKeel, bicycle and pedestrian coordinator for the City of Durham and the Bikeway's DCHC project manager. The study team's inclusion of demographic questions in its survey attempts to address equity by seeing whose voices have not been heard, McKeel says. Considering how the bikeway will intersect with existing public transport systems also balances equity questions. While the study team doesn't have ideas of ways to provide bikes for those who lack their own, McKeel mentions that some cities along the route have their own bike share programs that people may be allowed to use on that bikeway. There are also organizations like the Durham Bike Co-op that allow people to obtain bikes cheaply or for free after volunteering a certain number of hours. The NC Department of Transportation allocates just 0.1% of its almost $5 billion budget to cycling. NCDOT also can't use state funds to support independent bicycle and pedestrian improvements if they aren't lumped in with other projects. But federal programs could help cut the state's red tape. About 200 environmental and transportation organizations are pressing President Joe Biden to use $10 billion from the proposed American Jobs Plan for a Greenway stimulus. The program would complete hundreds of proposed greenways or walking and biking trails. The proposed National and Regional Greenways Act, introduced in the U.S. House, would create a grant program within the U.S. Department of Transportation specifically for greenways projects. The Connecting America's Active Transportation System Acts, CAATS, introduced in the U.S. Senate, would create a $500 million annual fund for grants to connect pedestrian and cycling infrastructure. Community project requests have also been used to fund greenways. McKeel says the bikeway could also use a private-public partnership or apply for a RAISE grant worth up to $25 million, though the grants are highly competitive. If the project is able to secure a large chunk of funding, some money could be used to address other gaps in the Triangle's transit system, says McKeel, but his hands are tied at a certain point, he says. This is a project that has gotten a lot of attention, but we recognize there are a lot of needs in existing communities and other parts of Durham-Chapel Hill-Carrboro. Funding for this project will also be considered in relation to the other needs that exist. Ultimately, elected officials make those decisions about funding priorities. Well, the print issue, which came out on Wednesday, this is now Friday, does not contain the very most current articles in some areas, and I'm going to read one or two of those from the IndyWeek.com website. The first one, Senate leader Phil Berger vows to keep critical race theory out of schools. He attacked critical race theory on Wednesday, pledging to fight against the controversial doctrine he contends has taken root in some North Carolina schools. Most educators say critical race theory is not being taught in North Carolina schools. He said during a late morning press conference, "I oppose it, and I will combat it with everything that I have because I believe the doctrine undoes the framework that produced the most successful ongoing experiment in self-government in the history of mankind." His remarks came a few hours before the Senate was scheduled to take up House Bill 324, which would restrict what public schools can teach students about America's racial past. He said, "Children must learn about our state's racial past and all of its ugliness, including the cruelty of slavery, to the 1898 Wilmington Massacre to Jim Crow. But students must not be forced to adopt an ideology that is separate and distinct from history, an ideology that attacks the very foundations of the liberal order and that promotes present discrimination, so long as it's against the right people, as anti-racist." As Policy Watch reported last month, critical race theory is an academic discipline that examines how American racism has shaped law and public policy. CRT emerged in the Legal Academy in the 1980s as an offshoot of critical legal studies. Critics say they fear it will be used to teach young, impressionable students that America and white people are inherently and irredeemably racist. They often share stories about young white children who, after learning hard truths about American racism, return from school stung by the revelation that, historically, the nation has been imperfect in its treatment of blacks and other people of color. Meanwhile, proponents say it's important that children learn hard truths about the nation's racial past, warts and all. Durham activist Paul Scott is watching HB 324 closely. Scott shared a letter he wrote to Berger on Tuesday calling the senator's stance against anti-racism education a, quote, literary lynching of black children. He wrote, "Now more than ever, our children need to know the truth about American history. You and others seem to be determined to push America back to the era of whites-only water fountains and restrooms." Scott helped to convince Durham Public Schools and the Durham City Council to adopt resolutions that support teaching critical race theory. Berger complained that the Durham City Council authorized a racial equity task force that's steeped in critical race ideology. He says it tells us that the current education system is working as it was designed to indoctrinate all students with the internalized belief that the white race is superior. If government officials really believe that, one needn't think too hard about what kind of steps they're taking to fix that problem. Berger was also critical of anti-racism education efforts in Charlotte Mecklenburg schools, where he said the district tells students that it's, quote, no longer enough to be passively not racist, and that they must be anti-racists. He said today's anti-racist literature, embraced by some school districts in North Carolina, preaches that discrimination by race is not inherently racist, and the only remedy to past discrimination is present discrimination. The Senate leader said he will introduce a constitutional amendment that reinforces the Civil Rights Act of 1964. He said it will be patterned after similar amendments in the constitutions of California and Michigan. And he added, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, one of our country's greatest advancements toward realizing the promise of America's founding principles, prohibits discrimination against a person because of such individual's race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. He said then, U.S. Senator Barack Obama was right in 2004 when he said there is only one America. Obama was elected president in 2008 and again in 2012. Berger said to those who heard those words, America's first black president was saying there is no white or black or Latino or Asian America. There is only one America, undefined by color. Earlier this week, Berger shared two articles about critical race theory on his website, the Senator Berger Press Shop, that he described as well-reasoned and well-researched, that offered countervailing perspective to the one pushed by critical race theory proponents. One article was written by Kevin Drum, who formerly wrote for Mother Jones, and the other by Andrew Sullivan, a former writer for New York Magazine. Back to the print issue and an article by Carol Espinoza-Jane called Ongoing Struggle about Latinx residents of Cary's mobile estates. For more than 10 years, Damaris Colin de Paz has not received the title to the mobile home she owns in Cary's mobile estates trailer park, nicknamed Las Americas. She's one of dozens of Latinx residents of the park who organized and approached the North Carolina Attorney General's office to request an investigation into the missing titles and accounting issues with mobile estates management. Since an April report published in Indy, a total of 30 residents, up from 20 since last October, have now received their titles, according to Sandra Bueno, an organizer with One Wake and the NC Congress of Latino Organizations. But progress has been slow, Bueno says, and at least 47 families are still awaiting titles. A State Department of Justice investigation is ongoing, and residents say they continue to be bombarded with a barrage of fines and eviction notices from mobile estates. Colinda Paz, a longtime resident, told Indy that even though mobile estates has refused to relinquish her title, she still had to pay for repairs to her home. Her yard, she says, has had flooding issues that have not been addressed for many years. She can't cut her grass, she says, or else flooding gets worse, and because of that, she has received multiple fines. She is allowed to park her car only on a small patch of gravel by the road where it has been damaged three times. Colinda Paz has received more than 20 eviction threats and letters from mobile estates and many other letters charging her increasing amounts for trash, water, and pet fees. Her rent, which initially started at $345, was recently increased to $360 a month. Now she refuses to pay mobile estates owner Byrne Bullard until she receives her title. She says, he has the right to charge whatever he wants, and okay, I really could pay him all this money, as long as he also supports me and fixes everything I have problems with. I told him I wasn't going to pay him until I get my title. The eviction notices have taken a toll on the community, Colinda Paz says. Her former neighbor died by suicide earlier this year, she says, because his family was unable to keep up with payments. His mobile home stands vacant next to her home. Coming to my neighbor's house makes me want to cry, she says. G. Hernandez, a construction worker and resident in Las Americas, said he has also faced multiple issues with mobile estates regarding his property. After letting a pregnant neighbor borrow one of his parking spots, Hernandez's mobile estates has not returned his parking spot to him. He is now allowed to park his Ford Ranger by a patch of grass in the corner of his property, where he says the vehicle juts out into the streets and has been hit twice by a car. "What would you do if someone took away your parking spot?" he said. "Of course, you'd go up to complain about it." Parking has not been the only issue for Hernandez. He and many of the other residents say Mobile Estates has also incorrectly charged him in pet and trash fees. The managing company has tried to take away his construction tools in the past, he says. Last Friday, he met with the general manager at Las Americas to finally discuss his land problems. "It's like being a mechanic," he said. "Without his tools, he can't work and make a living, so that's why I'm going up to talk to these folk." Another resident at Las Americas, Carlos Carmona Tagle, also has similar problems. Recently, Carmona Tagle went to court after receiving an eviction notice despite his making monthly rent payments on time. In a letter to North Carolina Real Estate Commission, Carmona Tagle said he was also being charged late fees and other unclear charges, and the connecting with Mobile Estates management was nearly impossible. Hernandez says it took months before he could speak to the management about his parking problems, and Colleen DePaz said the front office at Mobile Estates also is uncommunicative. Carmona Tagle said in his letter to the North Carolina Real Estate Commission, "Over the years, the accountant has ignored telephone calls, emails, and requests to speak regarding our accounts to this day. Now that I'm asking for a contract on my rental terms, I anticipate I may be charged for new fees they've added and cannot prove. I am not the only one with these complaints." Matt Waters, an attorney for the company, said in an email to the Indy that Mobile Estates, quote, "through its legal counsel, has been working with the North Carolina Department of Justice to rectify certain issues raised by certain residents." The process of repairing mobile home titles is complicated, Waters continued, and was compounded by the pandemic slowing work at the North Carolina DMV. He says Mobile Estates denies allegations against it from earlier news reports, and that Mobile Estates, quote, has repaired titles and made significant progress, even during the pandemic. But Bueno and the residents say Bullard and his team know how to target residents through various means, from eviction notices to arbitrarily raising rent and assigning random fees to shutting off residents' waters. Still, they remain steadfast in their organizing efforts. Colin DePaz says, "He has so many trailers already and he still wants to take away ours. He's going to have a hard time with mine. I could end up homeless, but I'm going to hit him where it hurts." On to news from Chapel Hill and a column written by Sarah Pequeño and Tomasi McDonald called Race Reckoning. UNC Chapel Hill's Black Student Movement has delivered multiple lists of demands to the university's administration over its 50-plus years on campus. The first was in 1968, when they demanded the creation of the African, African-American, and Diaspora Studies Department, more black people in the administration, and better working conditions for staff. The most recent was a few weeks ago, when the 54th iteration of the group presented 13 demands to Chancellor Kevin Guskiewicz's administration, alongside the four demands they shared at a demonstration in support of Nicole Hannah-Jones. Although Hannah-Jones declined the position at UNC's School of Journalism and Media and took her talents to historically black Howard University, the Black Student Movement, BSM, and other black community groups aren't letting the administration sidestep the systemic racism that plagues the state's flagship university. Instead, BSM, the Carolina Black Caucus, and the UNC Black Graduate and Professional Student Association consolidated their group's demands for the university. In the end, they settled on 9 action items that BSM presents. President Talija Van says she believes the school could accomplish within 6 months. At a July 7th press conference, she said, "Understand, in the next few weeks and months, we are holding the university's feet to the fire. We want to see action taken on these demands. These are actionable items." The short list focuses on safety and equity. The former has been especially pressing in recent weeks following the way that UNC campus police responded to protesters at the emergency Board of Trustees meeting to vote on Hannah Jones' tenure. The groups are calling for the termination of Officer Rasheem Holland, who was recently promoted to interim police chief after former chief David Perry resigned. The appointment was announced on July 6th, 1 week after Holland was involved in a skirmish with students at the trustees' meeting. Annabelle Friedman, a UNC Chapel Hill senior not involved with the black student movement, was in attendance that day. She says it was nearing 3 p.m. when about 75 black students, journalism professors, and others were allowed into the meeting. She notes that all of the more than dozen officers lining the hall to the meeting room were white, except for Holland and a Hispanic cop with the surname Gonzalez. Once the meeting started, the trustees voted to close the meeting without explanation, and demonstrators were told to leave. She said most of the onlookers left quickly, but four black students, two men and two women, stayed inside holding protest signs. Friedman said, "The police ignored me. There were two other white women inside who were ignored as well." She says once the police hustled the students out into the hallway, the pushing became more aggressive. "The five or six officers involved also started shoving the students," she added. She described Holland as the most aggressive officer and said he seemed upset that a black female student told him he was a puppet for the master. On videos posted to Twitter, you can see a hand holding a cell phone strike one of the students in the face, knocking off her mask. Friedman confirms that it was Holland, although she isn't sure if it was before or after the puppetry comment. She said he hit her on her left cheekbone with his left hand. You can see it on the video, and he was not in a defensive position. On July 6th, BSM released a statement that unequivocally condemns Holland's promotion to interim police chief, saying it creates a clear and present threat to the safety of black students. The next day, Guskowitz announced that an external investigation would be conducted into the department's behavior and that his team would be assembling, quote, a campus climate plan to address the concerns shared by students, faculty, and staff. It harkened back to the 2019 external review of how UNCPD interacted with activists protesting Silent Sam's existence on campus. The external review, conducted by former FBI Assistant Director Chris Swecker, determined that police acted accordingly, contradicting the experiences of students, footage on social media, and body cam footage that showed officers at Silent Sam protests praising a neo-Confederate outfit in Alamance County and using slurs when speaking about protesters. Additionally, Swecker went on a Fox News show this year to say the January 6th insurrection had signs of being implemented by Antifa. Guskowitz said, quote, "I am grateful for the continued advocacy of the Black Student Movement, the Carolina Black Caucus, and the Black Graduate and Professional Student Association." Another focus of the group's safety demands is the full integration of the UNC Anti-Racist Alert System, a text system created by the Carolina community with the school's official safety mechanism, Alert Carolina. The system's necessity has been cited repeatedly, including this weekend after two members of the neo-Confederate group, Alamance County Taking Back Alamance County, brought Confederate flags to the campus Unsung Founders Memorial, where they spit and threw dirt on it. De'Ivion Drew, UNC senior and member of the Campus Safety Commission for the last 2 years, mentioned at the press conference that the group had submitted more than 50 recommendations since its inception, but the university has not followed through. Drew said, "The Campus Safety Commission can't be a band-aid on a gaping wound. We will continue to struggle to bring marginalized students and others in our community into a space where each student feels valued and included. But we cannot do it alone, and we cannot succeed in this current environment. Now, following up on that a bit is an article again on the online IndieWeek.com, which is written by Sarah Pequeno. As the story of Nicole Hannah-Jones' tenure battle unfolded, she said more than once that the treatment she received from the UNC Chapel Hill administration and Board of Trustees was bigger than her, which many took as a reference to the mistreatment black people, particularly women, face in academia. Last night, she tweeted a similar line. This time, the subject was not UNCCH's track record of racist policies. It was talk that the university's chancellor, Kevin Guskiewicz, could be ousted from his role and replaced by a mouthpiece for the North Carolina GOP. The UNC Faculty Council held an emergency meeting Wednesday after Chair Mimi Chapman says she was informed over the weekend that the university and UNC system leadership were moving to replace Guskiewicz and compiling a list of names for his replacement. She specifically heard that, in her words at today's meeting, too, quote, at best controversial men, Clayton Summers, the UNCCH Vice Chancellor of Public Affairs and a member of the university's Board of Trustees, and John Hood, the current president of Art Pope's John Locke Foundation, were on the short list. In an unusual move, the Board of Trustees also declined the chancellor's recommendation for new leadership at the board, as an influx of new members were seated this week. Nor did they ask Chapman or other faculty and staff leaders to speak at the trustee meetings this week, as they routinely do. Over the weekend, two trustees also were quoted in stories reported by NC Policy Watch about examining how tenure is awarded. Chapman said at the meeting, it is a lot of smoke, in my estimation, for there to be no fire. The Faculty Council is drafting a resolution of support for Guskiewicz, although, Chapman acknowledged, our chancellor is not perfect. It said, a change in leadership at this time would be deeply destabilizing to the state, the people we serve, and the UNC system. We emphatically oppose it, because it does not follow the principles of shared governance, consultation, and established means of leadership change. Summers, the former chief of staff for NC House Speaker Tim Moore, has been at the university since 2017, when the public affairs role was created. In 2019, he was one of four people to craft the now-defunct $2.5 million settlement between the university and NC Sons of Confederate Veterans. The settlement was created behind closed doors. Summers previously knew the SCV's lawyer, Boyd Sturgis, through their shared time studying at Wake Forest Law School. A Daily Tar Heel op-ed described Summers as, quote, a fixer who operated in the shadows. Hood, aside from his role in professionally and financially backing the state's conservative agenda, helped found the John Locke Foundation, the conservative think tank whose members denounced the hiring of Nicole Hannah-Jones. He also serves on the board of the Hussman School of Journalism and Media. A new chancellor would have to be appointed by UNC System President Peter Hans. The state legislature, again controlled by the GOP, is able also to submit two names to be considered for the position. This is a recent change. In 2020, the Board of Governors gave the system president the authority to add two names to the final applicant pool. At Fayetteville State University this year, the new rule meant that, despite a candidate not being a finalist on the list of names sent from the school's trustees to the Board of Governors, he was selected anyway. The calls to replace Guskiewicz are coming from all sides of the political aisle, but the wheels for any change are set in motion by the Board of Trustees, who are appointed by the Board of Governors, who are appointed by State House and Senate leaders. The only person who is democratically elected to the university's Board of Trustees is the student body president, Lamar Richards, the current student body president, and he was also the person who set a vote for Hannah Jones' tenure into motion by successfully petitioning for an emergency meeting of the Board of Trustees. Deb Aycat, a UNC journalism professor, said he received texts during today's faculty council meeting from faculty members of color who said they and others have little faith in Guskiewicz. He put it on record that some council members were ignoring the calls of the majority of the faculty in favor of individual opinions. Also newsworthy, UNC's Board of Trustees has a new chair and vice chair, positions Guskowitz had no input in deciding. David Bolick, the new chair, and John Pryor, the new vice chair, were two of the four who voted against awarding tenure to Nicole Hannah-Jones. They were voted into their positions unanimously. The Board of Trustees meeting continues tomorrow at 9 a.m. And let's have an article now by Fred Wasser, Turning a Page, about the Chapel Hill Public Library's reopening. To some, it may seem like long ago and far away. To others, it may seem like yesterday, Friday, March 13th, 2020. Susan Brown, the director of the Chapel Hill Public Library, says she has a very visual and visceral memory of the day of the library's COVID lockdown. At around noon, a staff member announced over the PA system that the library would close at 5 o'clock. That is, not just close for the day. As hour zero approached and word spread in the community, resourceful readers seized the moment. And Brown says, people were checking out armloads and laundry baskets full of books. It was this interesting mix of people being unsure of what was happening and what would happen next. And, of course, at the time, we all thought, we'll be closed for 2 weeks, maybe 2 months. Like other businesses, the library adapted and improvised. During the pandemic, it focused on its park and pickup program, a labor-intensive process serving about 900 people daily, with about 1,500 books requested every day. Brown says the tasks that require just one person during ordinary times took four people. She says, quote, it took 100% of our staff capacity. Still, the checking out of books decreased. She says, that's because the only way to access books was by putting them on hold using the website. There was no browsing of the stacks. And she adds, but compared to other public libraries, our circulation was very high. Chapel Hill is a town that reads. Now a page is being turned as the pandemic and the library begins a new chapter. On July 8th, the library reopened for browsing, although with some occupancy limits. Much of the furniture has been removed, and initially patrons will not be allowed to sit at tables or chairs. Masks are required. The library remains closed on Wednesdays, but Sunday hours have been restored. As the 10 a.m. opening of the library approached last Thursday, five adults and two children were waiting during a driving rainstorm to enter the library. As the rain eased up a half hour later, there were perhaps 100 or more people in the library wandering the stacks. At the main checkout area, the Hub Library Experiences coordinator, Mansir Petrie, a recent hire, was helping patrons navigate the new world of browsing. Petrie is among a group of library staff in the Library Experience Division who are tasked with making the library easier to use and removing barriers to its use. During the last few years, the library has adopted the User Experience, or UX, model, an idea that has been embraced in many different fields. Petrie says, the Library Experiences Division is about hospitality and stewardship of the resources. Something really good is happening here. I welcome and look forward to opportunities where we can just increase community interaction. And he adds he's intrigued by the transformative power of libraries, including the possibilities for cross-cultural education. For his part, Petrie grew up in Yellow Springs, Ohio, and went to Grinnell College in Iowa. He's a fluent speaker of English, Spanish, and Portuguese and has done international community development work in numerous countries outside the United States. Most recently, he was a program manager for the Peace Corps in Panama. He says, as a Quaker, growing up in the Religious Society of Friends, you really get a sense that there is a God in everyone. There was a real sense that no matter where you're from or what your perspective is, you're valued, you have worth. As I started to travel, I enjoyed working in community development, working with these communities and voices that were traditionally not as heard, hearing about how they wanted their development project to go, what was important to them in the community. Moving forward through the recovery and beyond, Library Director Brown says the library, quote, will be doubling down, thinking about taking us out to where historically marginalized populations and others are. What COVID really shows us is how many people, even here in Chapel Hill, still can't get to us. The library has been taking the circulator, which is our mobile library unit, to some of the mobile home parks and some of the public parks near public housing. The folks that work two or three jobs and can't get here by 8 p.m. Petrie says that one of the things that attracted him to his new job is that the idea the library is a living room to the community. He says, I think it's a real social justice thing, people who don't have access to computers, and this, to me, is such a service. It's very important that people can access what they need and navigate this world that is so digital. Pre-COVID, Brown says about 65% of the library's business was kids and families, both checkouts and programs. Over the last 6 or so years, the library has been working on building out its adult and community cultural programs, and she says, when a community is grappling with something, the library should be the place where we can come together and talk about it and grapple with it together. All right, I'll take us into the stage area of the arts section. And Brian Woods has written stage directions. It was June 2020, and Broadway actors Karen Olivo and Eden Espinosa, Monday's keynote speakers at the National Women's Theatre Festival, whose 6th year in Raleigh will be totally online, were feeling blindsided and betrayed. Olivo, who originated the lead role of Satina in the musical Moulin Rouge, and Espinosa, her longtime friend, who found fame as Elphaba in Wicked, had just learned from Federal Election Commission reports that the heads of the Nederlander organization had donated $160,000, the most of any candidate they contributed to in 4 presidential campaigns, to elect Donald Trump in 2016. Nederlander is the second largest owner of Broadway theaters in New York City. As one of the largest theater ownership and operating groups in the country, Nederlander also brings touring Broadway productions to Durham Performing Arts Center. For Espinosa, the morals and ethics in the shows she'd been a part of, quote, were in direct opposition of everything that presidency stood for. While Olivo realized that many in her community had been targeted by, quote, the xenophobia and lack of humanity under the Trump regime. Their own unwitting complicity in the donation was even harder to stomach. Olivo says, we both had brought a sizable amount of money to those houses, and some of it was used to fuel a campaign for someone who was trying to undo our democracy. In turn, we felt responsible. They took action. In a June 7 Instagram video last year, Olivo publicly vowed to withhold her, quote, artistic force and services from any theater, company, or persons who knowingly fund organizations that perpetuate inequality. The video closed with Olivo stating, we work too hard to fund hate. If you want my talents or services, show me your receipts. When the pair realized how little they actually knew about the economics and industry structures that circumscribed their working conditions and careers as artists, Espinosa recalls, they started pulling at the threads and in response formed AFECT, or Artists for Economic Transparency, a New York-based organization dedicated to researching and exposing the inequities present in professional theater. At the National Women's Theater Festival, their keynote speech will focus on their findings to date. NWTF Executive Director Johanna Maynard Edwards says, when we look for keynote speakers, we ask where the industry's heading and who's leading the field in the direction we want to go. Eden and Karen were at the top of the list. In their work with AFECT, Broadway has been called in and called out. Their Monday night address takes place amongst 8 keynote conversations with industry leaders on issues ranging from women as producers and playwrights to celebrating transgender artists. A fringe festival featuring 14 plays and intensive how-to workshops on constructing home studios, directing, and devising new works round out this year's offerings. It's odd to think of organized oppression behind the bright lights of 42nd Street, but consider these dynamics that local and professional actors know by rote. Cattle call auditions, where hundreds try out for a coveted handful of roles, and if you aren't satisfied with the salary, dozens more will snap up the job in a New York minute. Grueling, pressurized rehearsal room gauntlets, where the lucky few work demanding choreography, songs, and blocking 8 or more hours per day, and tempers grow shorter as opening night approaches. And should you get a reputation as being difficult by standing up against abuse or harassment in the workplace, you just don't get cast again. These and other factors form an environment ripe for economic abuse, the maltreatment of a systemically disempowered group. Olivo notes, we are groomed to be grateful and silent. The more that you uncovered, the more they had to unlearn. Espinosa, I trusted these people, had my best interest at heart, that we were all in the same boat, and that we believed and wanted the same things for each other. Then you find that actors' equity doesn't fight for our best interest, because they're interwoven so deeply with the producers and the theater owners. Olivo adds, we take for granted that people are making art and therefore they're good people. But a cold fact lurks behind the facade of theatrical camaraderie. Many of the developers and producers who fund, manage, and determine the structures and policies of these production companies don't have vision, aren't artists, are not looking for the greater good of humanity, and are mainly driven only toward making a profit. As a result, artists' bodies are routinely, quote, used as vessels to create something for someone to profit off of. This last year showed me how disposable we all are to our industry. AFECT seeks to educate artists in economic and professional self-defense and teach best business practices so that creatives can construct sustainable professional careers and advocate for themselves. This fall, AFECT will offer artists online classes in tax strategies and contract literacy. According to Edwards, the need for such basic skills among professional artists is dire. Quote, you'd think that at a world-class institution like New York University's Tisch School for the Arts, we'd have been educated in getting paid and how to read a contract. We weren't. Espinosa thinks that theater is decades behind other entertainment industries. Quote, in any other industry, there would be an HR department you would go to, which we don't have. Instead, we're supposed to talk to our stage manager, who's also in our union, which is a conflict of interest. Both actors say that audiences can significantly influence change in their industry. She says, as an audience member, you have the biggest power of all, purchasing power. When you go to the theater, when you consume media, you have to think about the people who are creating it and if those people are being treated humanely. Next, Dan Rucha writes a music review from Trippers and Askers and their new album, Acorn, which comes out, I think, today at the Shadowbox Studio in Durham. He writes, there's something about Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower. Once you've interacted with her remarkably prophetic vision of the near future, you begin to see it referenced everywhere. The radical acceptance and resilience the novel outlines in its earthseed religion, the notion that God is change and that individuals have the agency to shape their situation and create community, are strangely irresistible to many artists. Trippers and Askers the band of the former Duramite and current Ashevillian Jay Hammond is certainly not the first group to use this novel as a springboard, and on the new album, Acorn, he treats it more as a source for allegory than as a narrative to be recounted. The album's two halves roughly divide into visions of childhood and adulthood, of empathy and observation, with detours to a gentrifying New York City and the streets of New Orleans. Both sides end with explicit invocations of parable, tying together all the fleeting references that dot the rest of the album. Hammond has a keen eye for the way we interact with each other and the meanings that flow from those interactions. In the song Henry, which opens the second half of the album, he recounts a passing interaction with an elderly, homeless man on the street, unpacking all the charged layers of race, class, and so forth that divide them with the awareness of an anthropologist. He wants to relate to the man, but notes that, quote, "What I think isn't worth a dime at the shelter or on the street, there's not a feeling that flows hard enough." Ultimately, though, Hammond sings to end the chorus, "You learned my name, said thanks, and walked away." Surrounding all these observations is a veritable who's who of the Durham scene, including Joe Westerlund on drums, Andy Stack on saxophone, Ken Moshesh on percussion, Joseph O'Connell on organ, and Chessa Rich on vocals and keyboards. Together, they put a distinctive spin on the southern folk rock sound of local folks like Hiss Golden Messenger or H.C. McIntyre. Hammond's melodies are at once well-worn and unusual, and the arrangements burst with color like a spacious mix of saxophone, organ, and pedal steel in Pulsing Place. Nobody is in a rush, and changes come exactly when they need to. And then there's the driving psych of album closer Making Forests, where guitar, organ, and sax continually rise up to the sun as we marvel what we made. Throughout, Hammond is seeking community. It's safe to say that he finds it. And Dan Rucha awards Trippers and Askers 4.5 stars. Well, now, thanks to my incredibly efficient reading style, we've gotten to the end of our articles, and I'm faced with a mere 200 or 300 awards from the Best of the Triangle 2021 from Indie Week. And what I think I'll do in the short time I have left is not cover the food and beverage and dining sections. I'll go to the cultural and scenic and utility items that have been voted by the readers as best in the triangle, and I'll concern myself just with the triangle as a whole. Of course, there are many features about individual cities, but I don't have time for any of those. Best place to dance in the triangle, the Pinhook. Also, I won't bother to say where they located. You can find them. Best community event is the Durham Farmers Market. Where's the best place to hear rock and roll in the triangle and the Cat's Cradle? The best art gallery? Well, the North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh, of course. How about the best museum in the triangle? It's the Museum of Life and Science. Repeats as a repeat winner. The best comedy club is over on Hillsborough Street in Raleigh. Goodnight's Comedy Club. The best live theater company, Raleigh's Little Theater. And a little out of the off-base thing there, where's the best place to shoot pool? The Green Room. Best place to hear jazz in the Triangle, Duke Performing Arts. Best place to hear bluegrass and best place to hear blues, the Blue Note Grill. How about the live theater venue in the Triangle? And that's DPAC, the Durham Performing Arts Center. And leafing over, how about best place to hear hip-hop or soul? Cat's Cradle, of course. Best place to see an indie film is the Carolina Theater of Durham. The best outdoor music venue in the Triangle, surprised me, the NC Museum of Art. Notice out some others like Coca Booth and Redhead Amphitheater. How about the best place to hear world or international music? That would be a tie between Duke Performances and the Carolina Theater of Durham. Now, how about shopping? Best bike shop in Wake County, Oak City Cycling. They're over in Raleigh. Best furniture store in the Triangle is Trosa, T-R-O-S-A. And we have going on the best bookstore in the Triangle, Quail Ridge Books. Best place to buy musical instruments, Harry's Guitar Shop. What about the best gardening store in the Triangle, Logan's Trading Company? They're in Raleigh. Happen to be in Raleigh. Best consignment. Nope, that's wrong. That's just Durham. How about the best art and craft supply store in the Triangle? Anybody could tell you it's the Scrap Exchange over in Durham. And we have the best international market in the Triangle. That's H Mart. And services. The best nonprofit in Wake County is the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina. And the best place to adopt a pet in the Triangle, Saving Grace, repeatedly a winner in this category, I can tell you that. And there's so many pages to go through, I'm really approaching the end of my allotted and in 35 seconds or so, let's get to some food. Best donut, Monuts. Best bagel, Everything Bagels in the Durham Food Hall. Best, best hot dog, Snoopy's. Best kid-friendly restaurant, Elmo's Diner. Best tea house, the Honeysuckle Tea House. How about the Mediterranean restaurant, the Mediterranean Deli, Bakery, and Catering? Well, and there come our musicians, the Repeat Offenders, our old friends from the Irish Body Shop. And that brings to a close this weekly edition of Indie Week. And after today's broadcast this evening on Friday, it'll be available as a podcast on ncreadingservice.org. John Fetterson thanking you for listening this week, and we'll be back with another edition of Indie Week in just about 7 days. So long, and thank you again.